cross-border finger-pointing today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. President Trump says Mexico is treating the U.S. unfairly, and Mexico says it's the other way around.
It is, in a sense, a throwback to an earlier era of mutual mistrust and mutual finger-pointing.
Also, the director of a World War II museum in Poland reacts to meddling from politicians.
It's a little bit outrageous and offending to me because I am a Polish historian and I don't need any politician to teach me.
Plus, why a lawmaker in Texas introduced a resolution that says this.
The 85th legislature of the state of Texas hereby reject the notion that the Chilean flag, although it is a nice flag, can in any way compare to the official state flag of Texas.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. Glad you could be with us today. We're going to start right in with Mexico. The U.S. relationship with Mexico is phenomenal right now, according to White House spokesman Sean Spicer. But not everyone agrees, apparently not even his boss. President Trump made this comment about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's visit to Mexico today.
Right now, Rex, who, as you know, he's in Mexico. I said, that's going to be a tough trip. Because we have to be treated fairly by Mexico. That's going to be a tough trip.
Tillerson and Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly are visiting Mexico to discuss the implementation of the administration's immigration plans, plans that are hugely unpopular in Mexico. These come on top of the president's plan to build a wall and make Mexico pay, and a look at scrapping NAFTA. Alejandra Hope is a security analyst and columnist with the Mexican daily El Universal. Alejandro, do Mexicans agree with Sean Spicer that relations are phenomenal right now?
Well, if you look at the long term, yes. I mean, the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. Has been at a high point over the past decade. Having said that, the arrival of Donald Trump has indeed changed the goalposts. It has been a while since a U.S. administration has seen Mexico as something of a hostile power. And it's been quite a long time since the U.S. Has claimed that it is being treated unfairly by Mexico. It is, I think, in a sense, a throwback to an earlier era of mutual mistrust and mutual finger-pointing. That's not a good development.
And government aside, what is the feeling of Mexicans themselves?
I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump is not a very popular figure in Mexico. That this type of measures are deeply unpopular. First and foremost, because it is a threat to Mexicans living in the U.S. who are now facing, or at least about 5.8 million Mexicans that allegedly are living without proper documentation in the U.S. That has made this move very personal for many Mexican families. And that has created a lot of fear and a combination of fear and anger on the Mexican side. And that is likely to have political consequences because it forces the Mexican authorities to be probably talk a tougher game vis-a-vis the U.S. and probably constrains some forms of engagement with the Trump administration.
What is the main objection in Mexico to the new proposals on immigration?
Well, there are several objections to that. One is that it's basically criminalizing every single undocumented migrant in the U.S. And it goes well beyond what President Trump said during the campaign, even during the transition period, that only 2 to 3 million, quote unquote, criminals would be targeted. This goes much further. So this is setting the stage for relatively mass deportation. Secondly, this idea of sending non-Mexicans to Mexico so that they could their refugee or asylum status could be processed. Is, I think, a non-starter in Mexico, at least a non-starter without some form of compensation.
Let me just jump in here and make sure people understand what you're saying. It's being suggested that non-Mexicans might now be sent to Mexico under these new guidelines. Explain why that's so surprising and what kind of troubles it could cause.
Well, because it's basically doing punitive immigration policy on the cheap. and dumping that cost on Mexico. Depending on the size of the population that will be affected by this, it could be put severe strains on border communities. It could put severe pressure on social services all along the border. And it could create tensions on both sides of the border.
Alejandro Hope, security analyst and columnist with the Mexican daily El Universal. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Today in Mexico City, U.S. Homeland Security Chief John Kelly pledged that there would be no mass deportations or use of military force against immigrants. But the new guidelines do call for deporting non-Mexican migrants who enter the U.S. illegally to Mexico. And that could involve thousands of people from Central America and the Caribbean. The U.S. government says it can do this. Mexico says it's against the law and that it will fight it at the U.N. David Martin served as legal counsel for the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. First, I just want to understand, did this kind of repatriation happen at all during the Obama administration?
It did not, to my knowledge. There has been a practice of removing some people who are in the process of applying for admission to the United States back to a nearby country from which they're trying to enter. But that, in the past, has almost always applied only to nationals of that nearby country, of Mexico or Canada.
And so under the Obama administration, if you were, say, from El Salvador and you were being deported, the U.S. government would just fly you back to El Salvador?
That's right. There's a process before the flight, however, to obtain travel documents so that the person will be accepted on the flight and will be accepted when they land. And sometimes that involves ongoing negotiation with the consulate of the country from which the person came.
So why change this? Is there an upside for the Trump administration taking a new approach? Is it cheaper? What is the rationale here?
Well, I think there's a considerable misunderstanding about the possibilities here. There was a provision added to our laws in 1996 to specifically say that, at least in some circumstances, people who were applying for admission at a port of entry could be asked to wait in a contiguous country until the time came for their hearing to be scheduled. That actually enshrined, as I said, something of a practice that existed before, but almost always focused just on nationals of that other country. This provision didn't really get much use at all. And many of the current provisions in the executive orders seem to be written by people who have a memory of Congress's efforts 20 years ago to add this and some other innovative provisions to the law, or provisions seen as innovative, in the hopes of making enforcement more effective. But it's really very unlikely. I think Mexico has a good, strong case. It's very unlikely that this can be used on any kind of scale for non-Mexicans unless Mexico affirmatively steps up to agree to do that. And they don't seem in the mood to do that at all.
So Mexico can basically say, no, thank you. This person does not, we're not taking this person. You can't just push them over the border.
They can. And most of the time, the process of deporting someone from this country involves specific agreements that have to be worked out with the country of origin. Mexico has been very cooperative in accepting people that DHS buses back to the Mexican border in most circumstances, but they do check to make sure that the person getting off the bus is actually a Mexican national. So I think this provision has been blown way out of proportion. The possibility of actually using it, absent an explicit agreement from Mexico, is quite remote.
So many people from Central America actually have asylum claims and are seen as refugees, and the U.S. government is now saying they can make those claims from Mexico. Is that realistic and fair?
Well, this procedure, if Mexico would agree to take them back, this legal provision added 20 years ago could be done in that way. But all this will require some careful negotiation with Mexico. And as I said, all the current readings are that Mexico is
going to fight
for
it.
Understandable reasons. They're not going to be willing to do this on any kind of an expansive scale.
David, this definitely reads as a get tough policy, and President Trump promised that. Can you also read it as an attempt to punish Mexico?
Yes, I suppose it could be seen that way. It's a very curious combination of policies. The idea that we want to encourage Mexico to pay for the wall at the same time while we're going to essentially make noises about forcing people who are not their nationals back into Mexico, it's very hard to see how that's part of a workable
strategy.
Well, I don't see one. I mean, other carrots could be added, but that doesn't seem to be the mood of the administration. So I think this is something that's going to be revealed as a non-starter and a very odd piece of an overall strategy, any kind of overall strategy, to try to regain better control of migration generally. We need better cooperation with Mexico. This is a very unlikely place to start.
David Martin was a legal advisor for the Department of Homeland Security. He's a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Texas flag features a lone star against a field of blue alongside red and white stripes. But so does the flag of Chile. And some Texans have been caught using the Chilean flag emoji in their online posts. Now a state lawmaker wants to put a stop to it with an official resolution.
The resolution is fairly substantial for something that's really silly.
Dan Solomon writes for Texas Monthly Magazine.
Well, no one's getting in trouble. This is a non-binding resolution introduced by a Texas state representative named Tom Oliverson out of Houston.
Read us the language in the resolution.
The ending kind of sums it all up, and it says, "Resolved that the 85th legislature of the state of Texas hereby reject the notion that the Chilean flag, although it is a nice flag, can in any way compare to or be substituted for the official state flag of Texas, and urge all Texans not to use the Republic of Chile flag emoji in digital forums when referring to the Lone Star flag of the great state of Texas."
So Texas goes toe-to-toe with Chile.
Something like that, at least flag to flag.
And what is it about Texas and pride and flags? How do you sort of read this story?
I mean, Texans are very proud of literally everything about Texas. We like the way it's shaped. We like the way the flag looks. We like the beer that comes from here that's bad versus the beer that comes from other places that's bad. You know, we really do identify very strongly with Texas. No politician is ever going to be unpopular for, you know, big ups in Texas. And so, you know, I think that that's really where this comes from, is that, yeah, it's a waste of time resolution. Like, it's not certainly not about anything. Any resolution's kind of a waste of time because it doesn't have any authority behind it. But this one, you know, obviously is particularly silly. Yeah.
It's kind of fun because if you're using an emoji that you're trying to make look like the Texas flag, it's because you're proud of Texas.
Exactly. People want to represent, you know, their state. People are, you know, very frustrated that there is no Texas flag emoji. But if you introduce a Texas flag emoji, you got 49 other states that need a flag emoji representing them. And that'd be anarchy.
So is there a movement to get a Texas flag emoji?
I've no doubt that there are people, you know, petitioning Unicode, but that's actually an international body. So convincing them that one or each of the 50 states of the U.S. deserve these flags that people in Japan are going to be texting to each other, it seems like it's probably a tough sell. But there are certainly Texas-themed emojis. There are, you know, whether they're the Texas flag is always included, but so are, you know, Willie Nelson and Beyonce and other sort of Texas icons.
What's the reaction online to the story?
Some people are angry. I mean, most people, you know, Texans are happy because it makes them feel good about themselves. But then there are people who are like, this is, you know, American imperialism, and this notion that the Texas flag is superior to the Chilean flag is offensive. I'm like, all right, man, maybe read it in the spirit that it's intended.
Dan Solomon writes for Texas Monthly. He's been telling us about the dust-up over the use of the Chilean flag emoji for Texas pride. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Just ahead, a Palestinian priest plays host to Iraqi refugees in Jordan. That's on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're with The World. Iraqi forces say they captured the Mosul airport from ISIS today. From the outside, it seems like the battle to retake the northern Iraqi city is taking forever. Imagine what it must feel like for Mosul residents who fled when ISIS swooped in. That was 2014. Some of them went to Jordan, where one Palestinian priest has taken them under his wing. The World's Shireen Jafari visited the church.
When Father Khalil first arrived at St. Mary's Church, he had a lot of free time on his hands. That was in 2014.
I was asking myself and my Lord, why you send me here? Because there is nothing to do.
His boredom didn't last long. Shortly after he took over this parish, the Iraqi city of Mosul fell to the Islamic State. This led to a wave of Iraqi refugees coming to Amman. That was when Father Khalil found his new calling.
I start receiving them, giving them shelter, protection, attention, and the most important, to give them love.
These families were traumatized. Yes, they were lucky to have escaped Islamic State brutality, but the pain was fresh. The children suffered the most.
One day, I was eating with them around 8 o'clock in the night. As we are living close to the airport, it seems that one airplane was taking off, okay? When the children hear the voice of the airplane, they was thinking that this is an attack. So they start crying and looking for shelter upon the tables, the chairs, and the beds.
Numer Faisal Elias is one of the Iraqis living in Father Khalil's church. His wife, Shatha, chops cucumbers and tomatoes to make a salad. Numer and Shatha fled Mosul 2 years ago. Since then, they've been living in a space on the second floor of the church. It used to be a communal area. Today, it's home to 6 Iraqi refugees. Curtains separate the tight makeshift quarters. Laundry hangs on clotheslines next to a window. There's one bathroom and a shared kitchen down the hall. When the Islamic State first entered Mosul back in 2014, Numer says his family didn't leave the house for 4 days. Out of fear.
They start to announce through the speakers of the mosques or through the speakers on their vehicles that the Christians, they have to either pay tax or surrender or leave the city or they will be killed.
Numer, a Christian, was terrified. The family quickly packed whatever they could. With the help of a neighbor, they managed to get through ISIS checkpoints.
This was like a shock. This is my city, my grandfather's city from a long time ago. And we were there as Christian even before the Muslims. I never expect that they will kick us out from this city at any point of time. But this become a fact.
A Christian aid group helped Numer and his family get to Jordan, to Father Khalil's church.
All the thanks is for Father Khalil, who is a very honest and a man of peace.
But more than 2 years of living in a temporary space has left Numer wondering whether they'll ever have a home of their own. He has 3 daughters, 14, 18, and 20 years old. They haven't been to school since they left Mosul. What will become of their future, he asks, lighting a cigarette and shaking his head. Down the hall from Numer's family lives Qaida Hikmet. She's also a Christian from Mosul. Hikmet tells me that her husband lives in the U.S. They got married 2.5 years ago. She shows me a picture of their wedding day on her cell phone. She was supposed to join her husband earlier this month. She had an interview at the U.S. Embassy on February 6th. Then came President Trump's executive order that put a temporary ban on all Syrian resettlement in the U.S. Hikmet's interview never happened. She's heartbroken. I lost everything in Iraq, she says. I'm vulnerable here. I don't understand why my case hasn't been approved. Hikmet and her husband speak several times a day. Through my translator, I ask her, what is it like to live so far away from her husband? Very hard, she says. Then she breaks down. She's here by herself, her family scattered. These days, Father Khalil's church holds Mass every day. He says it's an opportunity for the community to get together. It helps boost morale. Meanwhile, the refugees keep knocking on his door. The latest family came from Iraq just last week. Their teenage son almost died when Islamic State fighters doused him in gasoline and set him on fire. The son survived, but barely.
I am working right now to send him outside the country to be operated.
Over the past few years, the word has got out about Father Khalil and his church.
So many people, when they arrive to the airport or to the border, they have already my address and my telephone. So when they get here in Amman, they call me.
And of course, he doesn't hesitate to take them in. Father Khalil, who's Palestinian, says these families remind him of his own.
I used to be a member of a refugee family. I know what that means. When we leave our home in Bethlehem, we left everything. Our relationship, our love, my school, my church, my friends.
So he says he wants to do whatever he can.
When I give some help to these families, I tell them, please don't be humiliated, okay? It's my duty to help you. In the future, you will be ready to help others.
For The World, Shirin Jafari, Marka, Jordan.
We've got photos of Father Khalil and the families and the church at PRI.org. And Shirin Jafari joins me in the studio now. Shirin, I'm really loving these stories you're doing from Jordan. That one was really moving. What are you looking at next?
Thanks, Jeb. For my next story, I'll dig into something a bit different. I take a look at why is it that Jordan has one of the highest number of women enrolled in colleges and universities in the region, but unfortunately, that doesn't translate into more women in the workforce. I came across one study that found that unemployment is actually higher among women who have college degrees.
So that sounds counterintuitive.
That's surprising, isn't it? And so I spent the morning at the University of Jordan and I chatted with some of the students about education and jobs. One of them is called Maram Ziyad and she recently graduated from the Women's Studies program there. She told me she hasn't been able to find a job. So I asked her, does that make you have any second thoughts about investing in a master's degree?
Sometimes if I think about this and this way, I feel sad because it's costing me a lot of money. And that money, sometimes I feel if I pay it for another things. But when I think without feeling, no. When I study, I open my mind. That makes me feel happy, actually, from inside.
So I'll be telling you more about Maram and women in the workforce in Jordan next week.
I love that. When I study, I open my mind. That makes me feel happy from inside. Thank you, The World's Shirin Jafari.
Thanks, Jeb.
Coming up, a debate about history and facts in Poland here on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. The Oscar-nominated movie Tana is set on a small Pacific island. Many of the actors belong to a local indigenous tribe there, and they were invited to a special screening of the movie.
It was their first cinema-going experience, okay? So it's in their language, and it's their story, and it was just brilliant.
The story of Tana, ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Politics these days seems to be about creating a narrative and sticking to it, no matter the reality.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer there getting a little creative with the facts. As we all adjust to the fact of alternative facts here in the present, there are other battles going on over facts in the past. And one of them is happening in Poland, where a museum is embroiled in a standoff with its own government over the correct version of history. The World's Nina Porzuki is just back from Poland. She's in the studio with me, and she recently visited this museum.
It's called the Museum of the Second World War in Gdansk, Poland. And it has taken 8 years to build. It's nearly finished. And last month, the museum had this very rushed opening. Scholars from around the world scrambled to get to Gdansk to see the museum because this exhibit might be closed before it even opens.
What's the big deal about the museum in the first place?
There's a lot of different kinds of World War II museums, Holocaust museums, military museums. This is a museum that's trying to tackle this entire war and look at it both from a Polish perspective, but also from a transnational perspective, how this war impacted the world.
And why would anybody want to shut it down?
When I contacted the Polish Ministry of Culture, I got a statement saying that they're unhappy with this museum because it's over budget, it's taken too long to build. But underneath everything, there is this debate about history. And the Minister of Culture has made public statements criticizing the way that history is being presented at the museum, that it doesn't conform to their, quote, historical policy.
Historyczne polityczne. What I love about the Polish phrase is you can translate it historical policy or the politics of history. Either way.
Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblett is a curator at the Poland Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. And the way that she described historical policy and what the government dislikes is that this particular museum isn't, quote unquote, Polish enough. It's a little vague. I know.
It's vague, but it's also really loaded in this moment where identities are so contested.
And, you know, I walked around the exhibit with a lot of historians and we're all just kind of scratching our heads trying to figure out, okay, what particular thing isn't quite Polish enough? Here's a clip from writer Konstanty Gibert.
I honestly cannot fathom their reasons. A government that wants to rule history is insane. Unless, of course, we're in 1984, right? We're not.
Poland is not Oceania, the totalitarian regime of 1984, by any means. But Poland is riding, you know, a wave of nationalism. After 8 years of a liberal government, in 2015, the right-wing Law and Justice Party was narrowly voted into power on a campaign promise of making Poland great again. And this idea of, quote, a strong Poland is really key. And one of their biggest obsessions is controlling this narrative, this strong Poland, through history.
Wow. Nina, I know you've been working on a story about your visit to the museum, so let's listen.
Paweł Machcewicz is a man on the wrong side of history.
Okay, so is it okay? Do you hear me?
Hear you.
Well enough?
Museum of the Second World War was Paweł's dream. He's a slight man, balding, glasses, your typical history professor. So immersed in the past, he's got no time for the present. Or breakfast, for that matter.
I had some old bread, but I made toast. Yes, it was okay. And what did you have for breakfast?
8 years ago, he wrote an editorial for a Polish newspaper. He declared it high time for the country to build the comprehensive museum of World War II. To his surprise, the previous government gave him the green light. But from the get-go, the Law and Justice Party has publicly criticized his idea.
They criticized that this museum does not present the glorious sides of the war. They criticized that this is a pacifist museum, that we show the war as a great tragedy.
And the war, according to the Law and Justice Party, can, quote, shape characters and make people brave and industrious.
It's a little bit outrageous and offending to me because I am a Polish historian and I devoted most of my life to Polish history and I don't need any politician to teach me.
When Law and Justice came to power in 2015, they enacted a plan to get rid of Paweł as the museum's director by merging his museum with a new, more patriotic, yet-to-be-built museum.
In a way, I expected that it would be coming. In 1 month, I could be already ousted.
It's hard to understand why history matters so much in Poland without understanding the effect World War II had on this nation. As Americans, we think about the war and we think the greatest generation, beating down fascism, Tom Hanks heroics. But this was a very different war for Poland.
Poland, September 1939. The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest.
The first shots of the war were fired here, where the museum was built, in Gdansk. And for 6 years, Poland was fought over on both fronts, occupied by Stalin and the Soviets in the east and the Germans from the west. It was a bitter battle on Polish soil. No village untouched.
Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved.
More than 5 million Poles died during the war. 3 million of those Polish Jews. Think about that. 5 million people. One-fifth of the population. Many Polish families still live in the shadow of the war.
I remember the stories of my mother.
Paweł's mother was just 4 years old during the Warsaw Uprising. She remembers the day when German soldiers came to her house, took her family to a square, and began executing people.
So my mother saw people who were killed, you know, blood, people falling down.
These are the childhood memories of his mother.
This is not unique.
Many Polish families have similar stories. In fact, after the museum put out a call to Poles to donate their personal relics from the war, Paweł and his staff were inundated with objects.
Just in a few months, we got 3,000 or 4,000 objects.
Like a handwritten letter donated by Joanna Pinson. I met Joanna outside the exhibit. She was sitting quietly, watching all of the historians mill about.
You don't know, but I am very old. I am 95 now. Yeah, I was 17 when the war began.
Joanna was part of the Polish underground resistance. She was caught by the Germans shortly after the war began and sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany for 4 years. She was able to send this letter to her parents to let them know she was still alive.
For me, it is not an exhibition. It is rather raczej moje wspomnienia, prawda?
So for me, it's rather the memories. It's just like evoking my memories.
For Pavel, the truth of the war is in the memories of Joanna and his mother. One of the most evocative parts of the museum is a series of photos from Warsaw, color photographs of bombed-out buildings, rubble, wreckage, taken by an American architect in 1947. And there's something about the color that is so striking. So many of us picture this war in black and white, but here's Warsaw completely destroyed in color. And then suddenly you see people among this destruction. Everyday people dressed up in suits and skirts, walking on the streets, going about their day as if everything were normal. History changes as our understanding of it changes. Pavel Machsevich was witness to that.
When we started to work on the concept of the exhibition, it seemed that at the end it was an optimistic story, that we regained our freedom, that we became a part of Europe with democracy in place. And in these 8 years during which we worked on the exhibition, almost everything changed in the world, in Poland. We have got a war in Ukraine not far from our borders. We have Putin
is meddling in elections. There's a wave of terrorism around the world. NATO and the European Union are on unsure footing. And then there's Brexit.
You know, everything changes.
Underneath those photographs of Warsaw are a series of drawings made by Polish children in 1946, depicting their memories from the war. Stick figures with guns, growling dogs, blood, a crowd gathered for an execution.
The war can repeat. The violence is around us, is inside us, within us.
And just when you think, enough, sounds filter in from the final room, where a video montage is projected on the wall. The film is a series of historical clips from 1945 to the present, on a split screen. One side, the progression of the West, the other side, the East.
This is not a closed chapter.
Their trajectories converge in the present, on the bombed-out image of Aleppo, and a young man bicycling past the rubble on his way somewhere. The museum's future continues to be in limbo, but Pavel hopes to open to the public in March. For the world, I'm Nina Porzuki, Gdansk, Poland.
The Oscars are on Sunday. We've been sampling the nominees for the Best Foreign Language Film. Today's is a star-crossed love story set in the South Pacific. The movie is Tana, named after a tiny island on Vanuatu. Bentley Dean is the co-director of the film, the director of photography, the producer. Welcome, Bentley. This is based on true events, is that right?
That is right. It happened about 30 years ago.
So what's the film about?
This story is about an event where two lovers refused to do as their chiefs wished them to do, that is to marry the person of their choice, falling in love and basically taking another path. It's a tragic story, but it's one that changed the course of their custom and their culture for good. And Tana is set within a community that are still living an extremely traditional life. The people who we're working with, the villagers who we're working with, who are extremely traditional. Imagine, you know, grass skirts, still hunting with bows and arrows, living the way their ancestors have always lived for thousands of years.
What inspired you to tell this story? How did you come across it?
I'd actually been to Tana, which is like a tiny island, one of the islands in the archipelago country of Vanuatu. It's only like 50 kilometers by 20 kilometers, but it's got four different languages are spoken there, a volcano, like incredible tropical environment. And the idea was always to make something in collaboration with the community there. Like Martin and I, my co-director, didn't have a script in our back pocket. The whole idea was to actually work with the community.
You were invited into the village for the whole process.
That's right. So living there the entire 7 months were my wife and our two young sons, who were 4 and 2 at the time. Martin would fly in and fly out on bigger scenes. But essentially it was, yes, just us.
So Bentley, on the surface, this just looks like a terrible idea. White dude wanders into unknown territory. You know, we've got all the stereotypes in the world, potential cultural minefields everywhere. How do you even begin to think about doing what you did? And then what has the reaction been like?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. You just, you know, operate with respect. Martin and I have made documentaries. That's our background for the last 9, 10 years. And a lot of them have been dealing with indigenous subject matter in Australia. And we've basically, you know, developed a methodology that is based on deep respect in terms of collaboration, you know, making sure we get it right, making sure that, you know, Indigenous rights and culture are respected and protected. And, you know, it's sort of simple in a way. You just act like a decent human being, live by your words, and be, you know, genuinely collaborative. So that's what we did. We talked for the first 3-4 months, just listening and sharing. It was a two-way street. You know, like they would tell embarrassing things about their personal lives, and I would do the same. You know, and we lived together, and, you know, our kids played together, and it was a very sharing experience. And so the reaction to the film was great. You know, we'd always promised that, you know, they would be the first people in the world to see the film. And I bought a couple of queen-size bed sheets and sewed them together, and they erected that in one of the last remaining banyan trees there. I had a projector, and it was just a fabulous experience. Like, you can imagine all the tribes gathering from the area, and it was their first cinema-going experience, okay? So it's in their language, and it's their story, and it was just brilliant. It was like more like going to a football match than going to a movie. There was lots of catcalls, lots of screaming, singing along with the songs. It was a really sort of raucous affair.
And but they're watching like, themselves. They are the actors.
Yeah, it was just magic.
The film is famous for its photography. You do feel immersed in the landscape when you watch it. How did you do that? What is there some technique in there that's groundbreaking? How did you approach it?
I think our technique is very unusual for a feature film because of Martin and I's background, which is extremely small. You know, myself on camera and he's on sound, and that's it. Because we were living in there, you could work at their pace. And you were in their environment. It wasn't like you were coming in with an entire crew and in like Hollywood structure.
And finally, are any of the tribes people, any of the actors coming to the Oscars?
Oh, yes. So little Celine, who's one of the stars of the film, and her father, Linga, who's also in the film playing her father. And they are really, really keen to wear their traditional dress. So imagine like a numbus, which is like a penis sheath and grass skirts on the red carpet at the Oscars.
Amazing. Well, we have to leave it there, but thank you so, so much. Bentley Dean is the co-director of the film Tana, up for a foreign language Oscar this Sunday. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We interviewed the directors of all of the Oscar nominees for Best Foreign Language Film this year. You can hear those interviews and watch the trailers at PRI.org. During the Cold War, both sides tested hundreds of nuclear weapons. We used islands in the Pacific and the deserts of Nevada, but the Soviets had their own testing grounds, and one of them was a place called the Polygon. It was one of the most intensely nuked places on Earth. My BBC colleague, Rustam Kabul, has just completed a documentary about the people who lived there. Rustam, where is the Polygon?
The Polygon, the Soviet Union's biggest testing site, is in northeast of Kazakhstan. It's very close to Russian border in the north and close to Chinese border in the east. It's a big place at the size of Belgium. It was the Soviet Union's biggest testing site where the Soviets detonated 456 atomic bombs.
456?
456.
And what is that landscape like?
Our landscape is amazing. It's an endless Kazakh steppe, but then you see this weird-shaped walls, ruins of other buildings like apartment blocks, but that is very contaminated area. You know, in some places, radiation levels are very, very high and you cannot really go there.
So when you describe it like that, I almost feel a sort of science fiction feeling.
Indeed. It looks like the surface of the moon or the Mars, because this steppe is dotted with craters, very beautifully shaped craters with water inside. The Kazakhs call it atomic lakes.
And what was it like to visit and report there?
It was scary. I was really scared. So we were holding our radiation measuring devices, and it's very strange. You know, one step to the left, it's normal. There is nothing. And another step to the right, and radiation levels are very high, and you have to leave that place. So this whole area the size of Belgium, is contaminated.
But people did live there.
There are still some ruins of old villages and houses, but people were evacuated. But outside of the polygon, there are dozens of villages who were considered safe, but unfortunately, sometimes the radiation clouds cover those villages. There are many people who are having these effects of the atomic bombs on their health.
You spoke to one man who witnessed one of the tests up close. Who was he?
We talked to Elugade Nurgaliyev. He's 82 years old. He's an old man, but he wasn't just an ordinary witness. When his village was evacuated, he and his fellow villagers were taken somewhere, and they didn't know anything about the forthcoming test, forthcoming explosion. They were not expecting anything like that. And he told us his story.
Suddenly, God save us, there was a red, red flame. Everything was turned on its head and a storm began. We no longer knew where we were. The 43 of us were put under doctor's orders from then on. New illnesses started to appear.
That's so disturbing. What were you left with from your reporting? What was the feeling you were left with after seeing something like this?
I mean, I met this young girl. She was born after the polygon was closed, but she's very ill and she has no future because she was normal, healthy child until she turned 17. And then her bones started growing and she says her jaw started growing. She used to wear size 3. Now her shoe size is 9. And she has a tumor, a brain tumor, and she has diabetes. One eye is failing. The doctors say everything is linked to the polygon. Her parents lived near the polygon, and they watched the polygon tests. All her 3 sisters have bone problems, deformities. And more than 500,000 people are now believed to be carrying faulty genes because doctors say their DNAs were damaged by the atomic tests. So it's very sad that some political ambitions may destroy people's lives and it may go on for hundreds, even for thousands of years.
The BBC's Rustam Kabul has just completed a documentary called The Polygon People. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Despite Polygon's sobering legacy, the site also became a symbol of a productive collaboration between American and Russian scientists in the wake of the Cold War. Russians called the test site Semipolatinsk. Until 1997, Siegfried Hecker helped design and test nuclear weapons as director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he was good friends with a Russian nuclear scientist named Rady Ilkayev.
After I left the directorship, I decided I would spend significantly more time worrying about issues of nuclear material safety, where it might be around the world. And so one of the places I was concerned about was what might have been left behind by the Soviets at the Semipolatinsk test site. And so I remember going to see Rady Ilkayev and asking him essentially the question, what did you leave behind that you might worry about? And he, in essence, said, you know, we're not going back to the test site because Kazakhstan has shown a lot of concerns about potential environmental problems. They were not interested in going back. So I went to Kazakhstan by myself with the help of some Kazakh colleagues. I went to the test site and I saw that the security was in some parts of the test site just non-existent. And also that they had metal scavengers out at the test site who were digging up copper cable. And I was afraid as to what they actually might find at the end of one of those copper cables, you know, from a standpoint of all the nuclear experiments that were done out there. So I went back to see Rady Ilkayev, and I'll never forget that time. I showed him the pictures that I took at Semipolatinsk, and he said, I'll talk to you tomorrow morning about this. And tomorrow morning, he brought his scientists who had done a number of the tests at that test site. That showed me that he had this moral obligation to go, in spite of the fact that they thought they were never going to go back. They did come back to Kazakhstan. He showed the obligation and the responsibility that they felt that they had as Russian scientists and engineers for what was done in Kazakhstan. And we worked together over the next 15 years to mitigate the problems that were caused by former Soviet testing.
That was Siegfried Hecker, former head of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He spoke with the world's Daniel Gross as part of our Nuclear Family series, a look at the relationships that keep us safe in the atomic age. To find more stories in that series, go to pri.org/nuclearfamily. That's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.